and welcome to Robbinsdale Revisited. I'm Pete Ritchie, the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
And I'm Crystal Boyd, another irregular member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
Today we're expanding our look into one of the most vibrant independent characters in local history, Esther Robbins Scott, the youngest daughter of our town's founder, Andrew B. Robbins. Esther Marjorie Robbins was another of the girls with brown hair and eyes. She was born June 26, 1889, and grew up in the orchards in Robbinsdale. Esther, by her own confession, grew up feeling sorry for her father. He had five daughters, but no surviving sons. She tried to fill the role of a son as best she could. She had nightshirts made like his, hated frills and ruffles. She climbed every tree and roof and loved the platform at the top of the windmill.
And I've been really looking forward to the Esther episode. When you look into this legendary box of papers, it was discovered in the attic of a Plymouth townhome. And it just has so much amazing stuff. And when you look through it, you realize we don't know just what Esther did. We also know how she felt about a lot of things.
Exactly, because Esther saved so much from when she was an 8-year-old schoolgirl, a college student, a young woman in love, and a family matriarch. She was funny, fiercely independent, and completely unapologetic about who she was. Esther joined Westminster Presbyterian Church of Minneapolis by confession, that is, publicly accepting Christ at age 13. Perhaps a relative encouraged her to become part of that congregation. We know that it was not someone from the immediate family because they were not members until later.
So let's start with her school days, because Esther was brilliant from the get-go.
She refused to be a stuffy academic. We know this because her 8th grade graduation essay survived in that Plymouth box. It wasn't a dry history paper or stiff recitation. It was a creative composition written entirely from the perspective of her pet, titled My Diary by a Dog.
And it's really fun. Pete, do you happen to have the transcript handy?
Well, as a matter of fact, right here in this box of papers and stuff, I've got the transcript. Do you want to read it for us in Esther's voice?
I would love to. My Diary by a Dog. March 28th, 1902. Today, my owner's father brought me to the place that is to be my home. I had a very unpleasant day, being shut up in a basket all the time in a horrid office. When my owner's father got into the car, he opened the basket in which I was to give me some fresh air. The conductor said to the man, "You better not let anyone see that you have that dog, or he'll make you put him off." Down went the cover, and I was once more in darkness. I do not know whether I will like my owner or not. She teases me a good deal. The next day, March 29th, 1902. My goodness, I was so lonesome for Mama last night. I just cried and cried. Every few minutes, my owner's mother came in with a towel and whipped me. I like her anyway. She seems to like me when I'm good. March 30th, 1902. Today, my owner and her sisters have been trying to decide what to name me. My owner wants me to be named Sancho Panza. But my owner's father wants me named Rob Roy. For my part, I like the name Sancho Panza better. March 31st, 1902. Of course, I'm named Sancho Panza. You see, I always have my way. My owner will not let me kiss her, no matter how hard I try. I'm sure other girls would let me kiss them. I never am allowed to write my diary when it is light. I have to use the light of the fire in the grate. I think I'm a lot like Lincoln. He always studied by the firelight. April 1st, 1902. Today is April Fool's Day. This morning, my owner had something in her hand. I thought it was meat. When I tried to chew it, I found it was wood. Then my owner said, "April Fool!" Of course, I was ashamed, having been fooled so easily. April 2nd, 1902. I am not quite so lonesome as I was. I am used to my home. Today, I got acquainted with Bose, my next neighbor. We had heaps of fun, and when my owner called me, we ran as fast as we could in the other direction. April 3rd, 1902. I now have a new friend. His name is Duke. He is rather silly. I like to play with him for a change. When my owner and her sister go to the car in the morning, I hide under the porch and follow the carriage. They call and call, but I won't come till they get too far to come back with me. April 4th, 1902. The velvet carpet was spread on the grass today. I am not allowed to lie on it. When no one was looking, I rolled just as hard as I could on it. I was thoroughly enjoying this rare treat when, ouch, something hit me. I looked around, and there stood my owner's mother with her awful towel. I cleared out and went tearing down the street to see Duke. But alas, I met my owner just coming home from school. I was hustled home and had a tear around the lawn with my owner. April 5th, 1902. Today I had my first lesson in sitting up. My owner said my back was not strong enough yet. April 6th, 1902. I can speak very well now. My owner's mother just took my chair to the back of the house and said I must not be allowed in any other chair. I really do not see why. April 7th, 1902. I had a fine time today. I sat on the cat every few minutes. She did not see the fun of it, I guess. I have just finished a fine, large ham bone. I had to bury part of it. I had eaten too much already. April 8th, 1902. Oh dear, I can't write. That ham bone made me have an awful sick headache. April 9th, 1902. I am at last allowed to write my diary in the daylight. My cousin Nippy has come to see me, and I am so glad. So you can kind of see the chaos of the life at the Orchards Mansion. There's these dogs running wild, servants pulling their hair out, and Esther is just sitting in the corner, capturing the comedy of all of this. She attended East High School in Minneapolis because her oldest sister, Edith, was a teacher there. But then Edith transferred to West High School, so young Esther dutifully packed up her books and moved to West High right along with her sister.
And you know what? When I was a kid, West High was the very coolest of all the Minneapolis high schools because it was right there in Uptown. And I wonder if Uptown was cool back then, too. She carried a 92% average, which was stellar for the era, and was asked to present Foolish Notions at the high school graduation exercises.
So this piece, False Standards, includes maybe a little poem at the beginning. I can't tell if it's sort of Scottish or what exactly it is, but we'll do our best here. So, False Standards. A wand some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as others see us. It would fry mony a blunder free us and foolish notion. What foolish notions would indeed leave us if we could but look at ourselves with the eyes of a stranger, and then if this stranger could but see himself from our point of view? To an American traveling in Europe, many things seem absurd. For example, this is in the stupid little town of Heidelberg. He hears music and with the crowd climbs the hill to the castle garden. As he sits watching the people, a man comes in with his whole family. They order their beer and biscuits, and for 2 hours they sit there sipping and nibbling. To an energetic American, this slow-moving German seems ludicrous and inexcusable. He is in Paris and during the day comes to the conclusion that Frenchmen don't eat. When, however, he goes to a fashionable cafe after 8 in the evening, he finds a different state of affairs. Everyone who can be considered at all in the swine is there. Ladies decked out in all the affluence of their wardrobes, men in dress suits with well-groomed hair and mustache, all are eating and drinking, laughing and chatting, making a brave show with the small earnings they have managed to get during the day. In London, he meets with the formality of the 5 o'clock tea. All business is stopped, even the match game of cricket between Oxford and Cambridge. Everyone goes in to take a cup of weak tea and 2 very thin slices of bread. We note the lack of enjoyable conversation, the precious time wasted in preliminaries and cold formalities, not understanding this glacier of Anglican indifference. On the other hand, a foreigner in America becomes dizzy with the rush. One Englishman stated that the only comfortable things he found in New York were the Hoffman House bar and the large rugs. His feet felt like jelly when he got amidst the throng. He saw a businessman suddenly stop, pull out his watch, rush into a restaurant, grab a piece of pie, swallow some coffee, and get back to work in far less time than it took him to tell it when he reached home. To him, this was the very acme of foolishness. So in this rather common habit of eating, there seem to be widely divergent customs, and all seem equally foolish to the Chinaman who prefers his rice with sticks. But we have other foolish notions besides the race for pie, notions weighted with more serious consequences to our nation. Could anything be more absurd than the craze of some people to be in society? The worst feature of it is the fact that society is sought not for any personal good that may be gained from a great number of friends, but merely for the sake of winning position and having notices put on the social page of the newspaper. Then, too, dress plays far too important a part. Women of society wake to think and sleep to dream of what they will wear on the morrow or what by next, though their wardrobes are already overflowing with garments worn but once. Their minds are never disturbed by deep thinking, and they live shallow, superficial lives, and the end of it is ill health, extravagance, jealousies. Nor are women the only followers of fashion. One of the important dressed-up characters is the college boy. He comes to have a good time and has it at any expense. When he blossoms out in full strength and glory, he is visibly radiant two blocks away. He is pretty and clean, polished as to his shoes, and so pink as to his shirt cuffs. He smokes cigarettes and eats at all hours of the day or night, marauding with one or more pals like unto him, and demurely assuming an outward aspect of reserve and innocence. Yet let us pass by him, for he is but convincing himself that pleasure is not all there is to be sought. We see men and women dressing for the benefit of others alone. Their one aim is to have others remark upon the beauty of their apparel and style. The most unfortunate side of this fashion is that it stirs emulation in the hearts of the sisters of the rich, who are qualified neither by taste nor fortune to rival them. Feathers that are really fine are admirable on fine birds, but feathers that merely aspire to be brilliant on birds of like aspirations are not admirable at all. The poorer girls are a sorry sight in their cheap imitations of unsuitable garments. How much happier is that well-known German, Herr Pretzel? He is a man of talent, though. For the time being, he is forced to play in the orchestra of a fashionable restaurant. His clothes do not worry him, and he does not appear for the pleasure of displaying them. It matters not to him if his hair is a trifle longer than his professional standing warrants. It's no trial that the skirts of his top coat are too much abbreviated, that his hat bears marks of antiquity, or that his trousers are merely trousers and not works of art. His world is one of sweet sounds and symphonies. His sphere abounds in melodious harmony. Yet how many whose spheres in life are far more enviable than his catch only discords? So many, indeed, most of the solid businessmen and the women who stand first in social circles do not depend for success upon clothes. Their title to success is based on something firmer, their own inherent worth. And how often we see those who have the foolish notion that great wealth is the goal of life. By this, I do not mean the man of wealth who acquires his fortune nobly, with an ideal before him of ultimate good and kindness. For fortune is a great and noble power for good when put to such a use. In truth, we feel that the presence of such as Helen Gould or Marshall Field is a true benefit to mankind. What do I mean is the man whose sole ambition is gain, gain, and whose first law is love thyself supremely. We herewith understand in the story of the little girl whose mother was telling her this fable. An educated pig escaped from a circus and fared forth alone in the world. As he went through the fields and began to get hungry, he found a tree covered with green plums. He wanted the plums, gazing with growing eagerness at them. He rubbed against the tree, but the plums were too green to fall. Then he stood on his hind legs and tried to reach the lower branches. "Oh, mother," cried the little girl, "that's going to be a sad story. Please don't tell any more." A sad story indeed, yet true in the lives of many of our millionaires. Their goal seems always just ahead. They strive for wealth merely to satisfy their thirst for gold, kneeling in worship of the golden calf. Do they not realize how much pleasure they miss? The guides and rules of society, the really successful men, are not necessarily rich men, but they are men of sterling character, of disciplined experience, and moral excellence. A poor man, though he possess but little of this world's goods, may in the enjoyment of opportunities used and not abused, of a life spent nobly and honorably for self, for home, and for God, look without the slightest envy upon the person of mere worldly success, the man of money bags and acres. False ideals about wealth, society, and dress are not the only ones we must guard against. Such standards are all about us. We must find them and with untiring strength overcome their powerful influence. What we strive for, that we are, and it is by our standards that we are judged. How important, then, that each should take a good, long, searching look at himself. He would rid himself of all foolish notions, and in their stead set up a true ideal of high manhood. An ideal is that great central aim proposed to ourselves by ourselves for inspiration, imitation, and realization. Ideals are like stars. You will not succeed in touching them with your hands, but like the seafaring man on the desert of waters, you choose them as your guides and, following them, you reach your destiny. The purpose which contributes to life power must be pure, noble, heroic, and unselfish.
The creative spark that followed her straight to college. Esther attended the University of Minnesota, where she was an active member of the Pi Beta Phi sorority. The July 1909 issue of the Pi Beta Phi Arrow actually mentioned Esther entertaining her entire sorority chapter with a lavish slumber party at the Robbinsdale Estate.
Oh my God, can you imagine a 1900 sorority slumber party in a 16-room mansion? I'm picturing like late-night poetry readings, secret ghost stories like in the library, and maybe sneaking down to the conservatory.
Or maybe sneaking down to the lake. I mean, they were right there on Twin Lake. It seems like a good time for a midnight swim. Esther really was interested in ghosts, and she kept notes on the noises she heard in the night. But Esther wasn't just hosting tea parties. She was an athlete. In July of 1907, the Minneapolis Journal ran a feature. Esther and a brave group of college girls bypassed the train, grabbed paddles, and took a fleet of canoes straight down the Mississippi River.
They paddled all the way from St. Paul down to Red Wing, spending days navigating the currents and camping along the riverbanks. The local press was astonished, writing that not many girls have the necessary skill and courage for such a novel trip. But to Esther, who spent her childhood climbing to the top of the towering metal windmill, a massive river was just another playground. And she grew up fast.
Yeah, she did. Does it really take days to get to Red Wing? Maybe they were just stopping and having some fun along the way. And I guess you'd stop in Hastings and trying to imagine some of the other places they may have stopped on that river trip. She grew up fast. Here's a letter from her father written August 17th, 1906. The letterhead has a little map of Robbinsdale, and it kind of gives you an idea of she's being treated a little bit more like an adult. I mean, I just can't imagine her father sharing business details with her and stuff like that. But on the letterhead, it says, houses and lots for sale, houses for rent at beautiful Robbinsdale Park, pure water, beautiful lakes, electrical cars, and ideal homes. So this is Minneapolis, Minnesota, August 17th, 1906. Yeah, he's writing her a letter all the way from Minneapolis. My dear Girlie, your letter of the 12th should have been sooner answered, and there is no excuse whatever for the delay. The Grand Army Parade was splendid. From Nicollet Avenue to Hennepin, the entire route was a mass of cheering humanity. In the midst of beautiful decorations, Minneapolis has added another page to the long list of honors achieved as the greatest hospitable cities. No decisive action has been taken by Anoka yet on the street railway matter. Eleanor is here. She and Ruth had a fine time, for Dr. Litton took them on an automobile trip last night. We look for Edith Sunday. All are well here. I am pleased to know that you're having a fine time. Lewis was at TB's to see the parade. I think he captured the Walker family by his hugs and kisses. I have not yet seen Frank Sturrett. Most important of all, I enclose a check for $5. With much love, Father. Let's have you read this wonderful letter from Esther's mother. Handwritten in Adelaide Robbins' script. She was a little annoyed at Esther because Esther had been charging something she shouldn't have down at Ruff's Grocery, which was right here in Robbinsdale on West Broadway.
I am so stricken, I am going to die. I have the slip with 30 cents for cigarettes. That ends it. You charge no more at Ruff's or anywhere else. I won't have cigarettes charged to me. You know that, but you don't care. I'll have no Christmas now or ever. Goodbye.
How would you like to come home and find that note on the kitchen table?
She really meant it. She really didn't want anyone to charge cigarettes to her account.
Well, I mean, smoking and what a woman smoking in 1907, a proper woman at that smoking. Within the next few years, she purchased her own grand piano and she kept it at home. She had it insured for $1,000. Now let's talk about the romance. Because of her independent nature, people wondered if anyone could catch up to Esther Robbins. Enter William Wright Scott, known simply as Wright. He was sharp, successful. He was an insurance agent originally from Fargo, North Dakota, who eventually founded the Fargo Rotary Club.
And we have their courtship letters. They were in this box from Plymouth. And when you open that box, you see all these letters, and they're pure gold. They're literally wrapped up in a silk red ribbon, so you can tell they're really special. And they completely bust the myth that people in the early 1900s were cold and formal, because in these, you can see that Wright was utterly smitten by Esther's wit.
And Esther's letters back are full of playful, teasing inside jokes and affectionate nicknames. You realize they weren't just a proper society couple. They were friends who liked each other.
And that love story led to their spectacular high noon wedding. That was on April 25th in 1911 in the music room at the Orchards, surrounded by 400 guests. After the reception, Esther donned a sharp gray traveling suit, packed her bags, and moved with Wright to Marmouth, North Dakota to start their new life.
But North Dakota couldn't hold Esther for long. Wright's career thrived, and he became the Minnesota general agent for the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company, a position he held for 30 years. The family eventually moved back to the Twin Cities, settling into a beautiful home at 601 Summit Avenue in Minneapolis. Born in 1922, Esther's daughter, Andrea Bonnie Scott, proudly carried the family's dynamic spirit. As a young girl at Northrop Collegiate School, she was featured in the press for her academic work on George Washington and her patriotic portrayal of Betsy Ross, and she later lived in St. Louis Park until her passing in 1980.
But for Esther, this becomes the era where she steps into her own as a businesswoman. In the 1930s, she briefly teams up with her sister, and they're managing properties and commercial lots across Robbinsdale.
She always loved dogs. Here's a clipping from the October 29th, 1937, Minneapolis Tribune Society page. Just ask Mrs. W. Wright Scott. She doesn't think so. Mrs. Scott, 601 Summit Avenue, the former Esther Robbins of the famous family that founded Robbinsdale, is a dog fancier. Mrs. Scott raises Cocker Spaniels and Irish Setters and keeps them out in the country near Marshall, Minnesota. In fact, she has 37 pups running around the garages and whatnot, which labels Mrs. Scott quite a breeder of dogs. There may not be anything so unusual about that, but now Mrs. Scott is named voluntary secretary to the District 43 of the Community Fund, and the director of that district happens to be Ray Beagle. Mrs. Scott knows a lot about beagles, but they are of the rabbit hound variety. Now, of course, Mrs. Scott sees no reason why her district director should make the speed of his namesakes and cover a lot of territory on this community fund collection business. How about it, Mr. Beagle? Mr. and Mrs. Scott and their family recently returned from Mill Ranch in Montana. Esther's heart was anchored to her family when Wright tragically passed away in 1952 at Abbott Hospital at the age of 63. Esther became the true keeper of the family flame. She lived on for nearly another decade, surrounded by the incredible things she saved. Her grand piano, the letters, and the precious christening robe of bobinet lace that her sister Amy had brought back from a French convent, which Esther used to christen her own beloved daughter, Andrea Bonnie Scott.
Esther Robbins Scott passed away on September 10th, 1961, at the age of 72. She lived to see the horse-drawn wagons of her childhood be replaced by the concrete lanes of Highway 100, which ironically claimed the land where her childhood mansion once stood.
The mansion was torn down, but because Esther chose to save things like the dog diary, Edith's poems, the notes for Amy's book, her father's Civil War correspondence, carbon copies of her mother's correspondence, her courtship letters, old photographs, and all sorts of ephemera, she ensured that the spirit of the Robbins family would never be bulldozed.
She climbed a windmill, she paddled the Mississippi, she loved deeply, and she saved everything.
One difference between Esther and her sisters is that she left a long line of descendants. Her daughter, Andrea Bonnie Scott, married Willis Lampert Walling and raised four children, Andrew Bonnie Walling, Wendy L. Lampert Walling, Phoebe Rhoda Walling, and Wright Scott Walling. Her box of keepsakes passed to her daughter and then to a townhouse in Plymouth. I love the story of how this came to the Robbinsdale Historical Society. We had built a display in the gallery for the 125th anniversary of the founding of the city of Robbinsdale, the quasquicentennial. In the display were lots of pictures of the Robbins family, a few articles of clothing that we had here at the museum. And a woman comes into the display and she's looking through all this and she's reading the notes on the Robbins family. And she says, you know, there's this box of letters. I moved into this townhome about 10 years ago, and I think they're from this family. And I said, they are. She says, yeah, you know, I'll bring them in and we'll have a look. And so she brings in this great big box and I open it up and I start paging through it. And I just couldn't believe it. Here's, you know, Andrew Robbins' Civil War correspondence. Here are all the notes for Amy's books, and not only the notes for her books, but poems and other things she's written. Edith's poems, Edith's notes, their wills, their applications to the Daughters of the American Revolution, their applications to the Mayflower Society, just all the trappings of those lives. You know, the courtship letters, like we mentioned, were tied up with this silk bow. And there were letters back and forth from really all of the Robbins daughters. And it was just such a treasure. So they ended up donating those letters to the Historical Society. But before we took them in formally, I reached out because Andrea Bonnie Robbins Scott, her descendants are still alive. And it's funny, these names keep appearing in these families. Andrea's oldest son is Wright Walling, is his name. We managed to get a hold of him, and he came here to the Historical Society and dug through the boxes with us. And he said, yes, this is, you know, my mother's stuff, and this is my grandmother's stuff. And he didn't really get to meet Edith and Amy, but he knew some of the other Robbins daughters and remembers where they lived. So it was really fun to talk to him, and he just happened to be the spitting image of Andrew B. Robbins. He looked so much like him, and he had grown a little goatee, so he looked even more like him. So it was kind of exciting to have that here because at one point he had lived in Robbinsdale. He became a lawyer, and he lived in an apartment building over there by Twin Lake. And he was here for about 4 or 5 years. And of course, he knew this was part of his family history. I just think it was funny that he ended up here just by chance for a few years. And I think he lives in Edina now. It was so exciting to have this piece of history just unearthed. Andrea's daughter lived in Plymouth for a short time. And it probably, the box of letters went from Esther to Andrea, and then it went to her daughter. It was just left in this townhome because she hadn't lived there since the 70s. And at some point, it was discovered again. So we are just so lucky to have that box of letters.
Really makes you wonder what else could be out there.
People go up into their attics. People buy a house. They find something in the walls. Sometimes old papers are used as insulation. They bring them here to the Historical Society and they go over in that box, and then every couple months, we go through the box and see what we got. It's always pretty exciting.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one. City every Saturday to see our friends in bus back home, sitting hand in hand when the evening ends. When the evening ends. When the evening ends. In Robbinsdale. Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.